I'd be back, and I'm back. Okay, yes, it's me. Did you miss me? When you open a show, you start talking about jellyfish, and it's not a fish, and RJ's going to explain, but for some reason or another, we are expecting biblical floods here in Southwest Florida, I'm pretty sure. Either that, or RJ's wearing a mask and a snorkel for no particular reason.
Well, I stuffed the snorkel with paper towels, so I don't need a mask.
You stuffed the snorkel? Oh, okay. Coronavirus Protection Elite. Yes, a snorkel and mask. So, hey, I get it. I didn't get the reference, but I...
Well, you got it now.
I didn't put it together at all. Coronavirus Protection Elite is a diving mask that covers your nose and a snorkel stuffed full of...
paper towels.
Paper towels, yes. Okay. All right. Nice. Now, I want to get back. I walked in, you know, and I said, what are you guys talking about? Now, jellyfish, you find them a lot in, you know, any of the saltwater areas, and we have the little iridescent blob-type jellyfish. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just kind of look like a star fruit. They're just kind of roundish, and they got edges on them. They're clear. And they're a lot of fun because they will burn you, but not on your hands. Your hands are too tough for that. So what the fun part about it is to take one of those little clear jellyfish and, like, put it in somebody's armpit.
This is not recommended to do at home, boys and girls.
Then you say, well, you know, ammonia is the best cure for this. I got some right here, and that way you can, you know, like, urinate on their armpit or whatever. But the truth of the matter is, just say, wash it off, and it'll get more burning and more burning and more burning. And the burning is very easy to stop. You simply dry it off. But we won't tell people who don't listen to the show. That way, you take one of those little clear jellyfish, slap it up in somebody's armpit, let them jump around and burn for a while. Eventually, when you feel better, you can just tell them to dry off with a towel. I don't think you could die from that.
Not the little local one. You'd have to really have to have an allergic reaction to it.
And then you have on the
but
very...
But there is a little one in the Pacific and around Australia and that area.
The box jelly.
It's a little tiny guy that's even smaller than those phosphorescent jellyfish that we have that will flat out kill you.
All right, so don't do this, because if you don't know the difference, you don't want to do that. Right? I thought that was fun, but no, this is not fun. We're not going to do that. No. On the other end, you got like the Man of Wars, and they get a big dome and long tentacles coming out. And on a previous show, I told you a story about that. But in between, there's what, the moon jellyfish?
Moon and cannonball jellyfish.
So, like the moon ones, you know, Robert's got a very cool video he took behind his house, and it's of a jellyfish moving along, and, you know, they just kind of, you know, puff up and squeeze down to puff some water and keep themselves propelling. But according to you, RJ, that's not a single creature. That's, what, thousands of creatures interacting?
Tens of thousands of creatures all together into one organism called a jellyfish. I mean, the Man of War is a good example of that, too. I mean, and they're even more specialized. Each individual cell is a creature. And they're all getting together to cooperate to be able to go down the canal. And I'm just saying, you know, they probably have almost nothing for a brain. And yet here we are as people, some of the most advanced brains on the planet, and we can't seem to swim down the canal together.
Yeah, I was going to say, no, wait a minute. These things, each little cell of this creature is a separate organism.
That's right. It's a separate organism. And they're specialized. Like in the Man of War, you've got the ones that are specialized, the stinging cells. You got the ones that pump them up so the sail works, you know, fills up with air. Each one, they've got specialized cells for digestion, blah, blah, blah. But they're all little separate entities.
Okay, here's what I would pose as the question. We're made up of thousands of little cells, some that, you know, grow this amazing beard and mustache that I have, and other ones that don't grow hair on top of my head anymore. Hmm. And then we have, you know, like skin cells and intestinal cells and all that. Is it that much different, or are they literally separate creatures?
They're little separate creatures, and I think that this is what millions of years of evolution have done from jellyfish to humans, is that, you know, our cells are less individual and more connected to us. So, and I'm probably not describing that properly. Somebody's going to call in and say, no, it's actually this, but that's our take for today.
In basic terms, it's true.
Yeah, there's all these little individual critters that have formed a colony, and away they go.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah, I thought there was, you know, it's not sexy, but it's damn cool.
Yeah, Josh is going to call in and set me straight, I'm sure.
Probably. They are elegant as all get-go, though, to watch.
It is amazing to watch them. And this one, going with the current, going against the current, they still manage to get it done.
Well,
and also watching them swim through the water gives you an understanding also, because there's two species where it's one of their main diets, and one is a sea turtle, and then the other one is a spadefish, which we have plenty of both around here. And watching one move through the water and stuff gives you a new appreciation of why you want to clean up any of your plastics and stuff like that, especially like a Ziploc baggie, anything that's more translucent, because you watch both of them in the water, and they both look very similar.
Yeah.
And they're finding spadefish are ingesting all sorts of plastics now, and sea turtles, that's been an issue for decades.
Right, I remember that. Which kind of segues into, you were out fishing Sunday, right?
Yeah.
So how'd that go?
It was fun. It was, of course, windy. The only thing we were missing was the rain and the cold, but the wind never laid down, according to the weatherman. But we went out to go look for tarpon and the pass crabs, because it was supposed to be a hill tide with the tarpon and the crabs flowing out of the pass. And we went with Josh, Mike Myers, and my girlfriend Christina. And it was too sporty to stay out in the pass because you get that opposing wind and tide. And it was a 2-foot washing machine. It was terrible.
What people realize is if the tide is going to the west and the wind is blowing towards the east, as the water's trying to move out, the wind cutting across grabs it and tries to build it, slow it down. So you got the water underneath trying to go, and the water on the top trying to go the other way with the wind. And what it turns into is, like, say, if you put your fingertips together on your hands and then run your fingertips up and then run your fingertips down. And we call it a washing machine because the water's agitating, not in wave pattern where it's going. If the wind and tide are going the same direction, you get waves that are on there. But when the wind and the tide are in opposite directions, it just kind of comes up in a lump and goes down in a lump and comes up in a lump and goes down in a lump. And there's no pattern to it. It's just up and down. You get bounced all over. Heck, it's a really good way to get hurt is what it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you can't reference or look and go, okay, here's a wave coming. It literally can just be right under your boat and just pick you up and set you down and pick you up and set you down. So there's no patterns to it.
No, yeah, there's no way to really control anything. It's just you're literally a bobber, you know, and it's not fun, you know, and being out in that pass can be, you've got to be on your A game to be in that pass to begin with, but in bad weather.
So how long did you spend in the washing machine out there? Now, this is something that's more prevalent or you would see really in a pass of some kind, some kind of channeled pass where the water's limited side to side. Once you get out in the open harbor, you get somewhat of it, but or in the open Gulf, you might get a little bit of it, but you actually end up with more waves.
Yeah.
But once you're in a pass that can find water and the speed it's going, I think is what makes it so bad. RJ, you're like the diver smart one.
Yeah, we don't see much of that underwater, but the thing with Boca Grande Pass, too, is you got the Peace River and you got the Myakka River flowing in to the
and
pass.
And at the bottom, you got the Caloosahatchee.
And the Caloosahatchee, right. So you've got a lot of water pressure going in one direction, and then when the tide works with that, you've got it three times. You know, the tide's pulling the water out, the water's flowing in at high speed, and then the wind starts blowing out of the west and tries to slow that down, and you get... I've seen 4 or 5 feet in the pass.
Yeah, where it's coming straight up and going straight
and
down.
And I'm telling you, it's like being in an elevator that has, you know, dropped its cable as it goes back down again. You go up, and it's going to bend your knees a little bit, but when the boat drops out from under you, that's where you get hurt.
Yeah, so it's very hard to control. And we just call it washing machine water, because if you ever look in the top of a old-fashioned washing machine with an agitator that goes back and forth, that we see is just a lot of up and down slop. Braided line and what knots you tie are a big thing. Because when you're fishing with braid, we've got tons of tarpon and sharks. They're all over the place. So people are using heavier and heavier line. Now, understanding why would it make a difference, say you tied a leader on, what knot you put at the end of the leader. Let's say you've got 50-pound braided line going down to 60-pound fluorocarbon leader. Now, you've aligned it together, but down at the end, would it make a difference what knot you tied on the end of that fluorocarbon leader?
Yeah.
Because it's kind of mono. Is there, you know, what do you have to be careful of there?
A lot of things. I mean, honestly, the main thing is the longevity of the fight that's going to put a lot of strain on that knot if there's a lot of friction being pulled against that knot. If it likes to pull back and forth as that line expands and contracts as you're pulling and it's going the opposite direction, it can bind on itself and cut through itself.
All right. RJ, any ideas?
Swivel.
Well, we came from the 50-pound braided line, and we tied a line-to-line knot, and now we've got about 4 feet of 60-pound fluorocarbon leader on there. Now, when you attach the hook, does that, any knots that you would use or not use, or is there anything you should watch for or not?
We're talking about the joint between...
No, we're talking about the end of the line where the hook is.
Yeah, I've always used the improved cinch knot.
Okay.
That seems to work for me. I've always lost that where the leader comes together with the braided line. That's usually my weak point.
This is just kind of a different subject.
All right. So down there, improved cinch knot is what I would use. Seems to work well for me.
Well, the one thing people always say, well, I'm using 60-pound leader, so I'm like, that doesn't really have any bearing on what you're doing. Because you pull with the line, not with the leader. So the line is going to dictate what's going on. If you've got 30-pound mono, that's what I would equate to 50-pound braid, as far as knot strength, breaking strength, how much you're going to hold with it all. In general, in a fight where you've got fish jerking and pulling, dead pulling, head shaking, all this thing, 30-pound mono and 50-pound braid are very equivalent to each other. Now, people say, well, it's 50-pound braid and it's only 30-pound mono. Well, mono tends to stretch and forgive. And so if you get a fish that pulls really hard and you've got 100 feet of monofilament line out there, it's got a lot of stretching and forgiving it's going to do and then pulling back to itself and, you know. But where braid... Yes, you've got 50 pounds on a dead pole, but as soon as the fish starts jerking, and say you got a 200-pound guy holding the fishing pole, and he pulls back hard against the fish right as the fish shakes his head away from you, that's going to pop the line. Or, in some instances, the knot where you tied your hook on. a palomar is one of the knots that most people want to tie in heavy fluorocarbon monoliter because it's very easy. It's simply an overhand loop. You put the loop over the hook. It's kind of like a square knot, but you do end up getting doubled. The problem with a palomar knot is it has one weakness. It is not good on a sharp jerk. It can actually be cut through or broke off or pulled out, whatever you want to call it. But palomar knots don't hold well on a sharp jerk. Braided line has the exact same problem. If you put a sharp jerk on it, you can pop it pretty easily. So now you've got a line and a knot that both have that same problem. And in 4 or 5 feet of fluorocarbon leader, there's not enough stretch to make up for that.
No.
So if you're going to put a hook on the end of the line with 50, 65-pound test braid or any of the heavier braided lines, and you've got your 50, 60-pound monofilament or fluorocarbon leader, not line, the leader, the knot you tie your hook on to should be probably, I would say, a uni knot's one of the best. Now, with the improved clinch knot that RJ's using, that's the one where you go around 6 times, you go back through the initial opening by the hook, and bring it back through your loop and pull it down. It works okay on this because you've got to squeeze that knot. It's got to clinch or cinch down, squeezing itself into the fluorocarbon or monofilament, which is the way it's supposed to be done, except for the fact it's very hard on those heavy lines to get that hook. You almost got to put the hook into something and pull with that. It's really hard to do with just your hands. You almost got to have a little opening where you can put the hook in and then pull that leader tight to make a clinch knot tight enough to cinch. Because it's a cinch or clinch knot, fisherman's knot, whatever you want to call it, but it requires binding it there. And when you get a clinch knot or something that comes undone, a lot of times it's because the fish is doing very violent head shakes, or you're working a lure with a lot of jerking motion, like a walk the dog Zara Spook style, twitching a mirror lure. You've got all this pop it slack and tight and slack and tight and slack, and that kind of tends to loosen the knot up a little bit. That's why a lot of times that comes undone. Whereas if you switch over to like a uni knot, now a fisherman's improved clinch knot or cinch knot is a 65 to 70% knot. But if you go to the uni knot, you're talking 95% knot. And because the uni knot, U-N-I knot, is a 95% knot, actually it's a lot stronger. And because it's formed in a hangman style, you don't have to clinch it or cinch it to the line. So there's none of this hooking the hook on something and pulling with everything you got trying to cinch it into place. You can simply form the knot, tighten it up. Once it's snug, good, you're done. You can leave a loop in it at the end, and if you get a big fish on it, it'll just tighten it up like a hangman's noose. But you're tying the knot to the running line of the line. So when you tie a uni knot, you're not tying it to the hook or to the lure. You're actually tying it onto the line itself. So it's actually quite a bit stronger, much easier to do. And the good thing about the uni knot versus a palomar, which is much easier to tie with a palomar, palomars do not do well when you're jerking it. A hard jerk can pop a palomar. The action of working a lure or a fish head shaking, head shaking, head shaking for 40 minutes the way you would a tarpon or a big king or something like that, you know, the larger fish that, you know, the fight's prolonged to 20, 30, 40, 50 minutes. When you're into that type of a battle, and a palomar works really good on grouper, and it's not bad for shark because you don't get a tremendous amount of head shaking. But with the tarpon and other species like that, ton of head shaking, tight, loose, you know, back, forth, back, forth, back, forth, tends to loosen these knots up like a clinch knot or a palomar.
Right. And then the other thing, too, is if you trim some of those off a little bit too close, you don't have as much room for error on those couple of knots. Because mono and fluorocarbon, they will swell with the water. They'll absorb a little bit of that water and swell up. And if you've clipped that tag end off perfectly flush – that little bit of swelling could cause that half, you know, baby's hair thickness of what's left there to pull inside and loosen up on you.
Yeah, it'll just come undone. You know, Any knot you do, I always do at least an eighth of an inch, but usually closer to a quarter.
Yeah. I like leaving a tag end. Absolutely.
The only problem is you tend to pick up a lot of weeds and grass and stuff like that just because that piece of line's sticking out.
Yeah.
So when I do a uni knot, I pull it a little bit tighter. I can't even back it off to make a loop out of it at that point. And I can cut that down somewhere between a 16th of an inch and an eighth of an inch and have reasonable expectation the knot is not going to pull through. Where with a clinch knot, you're talking an eighth of an inch minimum, usually preferably a quarter. But, so, what knot you use, if you've got braided line on there, having a knot that is not susceptible to a sharp jerk is kind of critical. Whereas, you know, that's why I was saying about putting a Palomar on the hook, that you get a lot of jerking because there's no stretch to the line. If you've got monofilament line and monofilament or fluorocarbon leader, you're good to go on almost anything because you've got all that stretching and it's very forgiving. But once you put braided line on, you got to think of a knot that works good on braided and not the 4 or 5 feet of fluorocarbon, because people always say, well, this is the leader I got. I say, you don't pull with your leader. That just gives you time before the thicker the leader. If you had 20-pound test leader on, they're going to wear through that very quickly. If you've got 60-pound test leader, the plastic is much thinner. So as the fish is head shaking, rubbing his jaw on it, gnawing down on it, it's not going to wear through so fast. It's simply thicker and stronger. That's why you got to watch out for fluorocarbon leader when you're doing tarpon. That's really easy to tie a knot in because that means it's a softer type plastic. And the harder it is to tie a knot in your fluorocarbon leader, the more abrasion resistant it is because it's stiffer. Harder, stiffer line is harder to tie a knot in. But the harder, stiffer line also is more abrasion resistant. So your fish is going to stay on longer. You might even be able to go down a size by, you know, using a harder, stiffer fluorocarbon than the softer ones. The softer ones are going to wear through easier to tie a knot, more supple for working a lure, having a bait swimming around, but you don't have the time with the fish on the end of the line before they wear through it.
Right. So if you're fishing open water, you could fight them with a lighter drag, with the exception of, you know, large fish, you know, like tarpon or sharks that are going to be doing that violent head
shake. Sharks would be a whole different story because they got teeth. That's like king mackerel, sharks, barracuda, anything with a lot of teeth. We want to get away from the plastic leader, the fluorocarbon and mono. We're going to start going to steel on this point.
Yeah, but I'm still going to have a mono leader going to my steel personally between the braid and the steel.
Yeah, I think it's a waste of time.
I like it just for a handle.
Now, as a handle, I can see it using, say, about 18 inches to 2 feet of steel, you know, probably 18 inches, because very seldom if even a big shark is going to overbite more than 18 inches.
Right.
So, and then putting some 100-pound or 80-pound mono or fluorocarbon there, so when you go to land the fish, you've got something for your fingers.
Yeah, even though I use a glove when handling any of those fish in the line next to it, I still want it just to be able to have a little bit more control of something to handle.
If I'm looking for bigger sharks, I've got 250-pound test steel leader on.
Mm-hmm.
It's thick enough. I use the plastic-coated stuff. It's nice and easy on my hands, so I don't have to worry about that.
I've got delicate hands.
You're delicate?
I'm sensitive that way.
Well, I'm glad you shared that with us.
Yeah, okay. All right. Big controversy right now. Tons of sharks in Boca Grande Pass. We've got hammerheads, there's tigers, there's lemons, there's bull sharks. And the bull sharks are what people tend to concentrate on. Although when the hammerheads move in, it's really kind of funny because here comes the boss. Bull sharks, 8-foot bull sharks, will back away, run away from a 6-7-foot hammerhead.
Yeah.
It's like the king comes through. This is the king of the sea. I mean, hammerheads are the boss. You can see a pack of 30, 40 bull sharks all going crazy, you know, doing the feeding and stuff. here comes the hammerhead gliding in, and the sea parts like Noah's there at the Red Sea. Just everybody just gets out of the way.
It's the weirdest pecking order that I can't even imagine.
I've seen that underwater, being in, especially in the Bahamas. You're in with a group of sharks, and you know they're all around you, and they're all doing their thing. And all of a sudden, it gets really quiet, and the sharks are gone. And then you look up, and there's a hammerhead above you, you know, doing the big circle. And everybody else left the area except for the stupid human. And
the weird part about it is, it can be the same size as the bull shark.
That's right.
And maybe even less. It doesn't have to be a 20-footer.
Right. And it's by himself.
And it's by just himself. One. There's a pack of 30 bull sharks there that have been going together to eat tarpon. Just, you know, one hits and they all jump in and bite. And they're a pack of marauding wolves, these bull sharks are. And yet one hammerhead comes in and everybody backs off.
Yep.
The sheriff's in town here.
That's right. I don't know what it is, but I've seen that several times where everything leaves and then the hammerhead glides into place.
Yeah, I mean, Frank and I have seen it quite a few times out there over the years, and it's just... And we've even pointed it out to some of the marine biologists that never noticed it before. And even on Shark Week, I saw, I think, last year. And it was the first time they ever mentioned it, was where they were, like, in the Bahamas, clear water. And they were showing all these big bull sharks around a feeding station. And all of a sudden, the bull sharks backed off. And they said, uh-oh, something's coming in. And here comes the hammerhead that they're looking for to film. But that was as much information as they give. They didn't point out that, hey, there's some kind of pecking order here, and the hammer is the king. You know, so it was pretty fascinating.
Just quick on the side, is there any truth to the story about old Hitler?
Yes.
The giant?
Absolutely, 100%. There is a hammerhead out there that's almost black. It's so old, it's almost black. And at least 20 foot, if not longer. He's gone next to my boat. This fish shark will terrify you when you're unprepared for it. All the hairs in the back of your neck stand up. You look over, you go, oh my God. And the dorsal fin, probably 4 or 5 feet tall, but when he's just kind of cruising, he's so old, the dorsal fin lays over like you see Free Willy with the bent dorsal. But when he goes on the hunt and gets excited, stands up stiff like a board. He just gets, that dorsal fin gets hard and stiff, and it's right up there. And I've seen this fish come from behind a 5-foot tarpon, open its mouth, and just go right over the tarpon, engulfing it entirely. From the back, not from the head first, literally come up behind while the fish is swimming, open its mouth and just swallow a easy 5-foot tarpon. And it could have been closer to 6 foot. And the thing that freaked me out, that really got on my nerves, the day I was watching this, it came right next to my boat because we had a tarpon on the front. One of my customers was fighting this tarpon, somewhere between 5 and 6 foot. He's having a great time, but he won't pull on the rod. He won't reel. He's kind of holding on. So this fish is on for quite a while. And all of a sudden, right next to the boat, the dorsal fin was almost shoulder high out of the water, within 8 inches of the gunwale of my boat. I could put my hand out just below shoulder height. That's how high out of the water that fin was. And he was under my boat. And as he went out, passed right alongside my boat, went to eat that tarpon, the most amazing thing about the whole thing is this fish is easily 20 feet long, comes up like a submarine, eats the tarpon, and goes back under the water and never made a sound. All you know, I have a 4-stroke motor. It's very quiet. There's the sloshing of, you know, light waves on the boats and stuff. There was no extra noise. You know, it wouldn't have been as chilling if the fish had, like, splashed and crashed and grabbed the tarpon and, you know, did all that. It was just come up from behind, right over the whole tarpon, close its mouth, and drop back underwater. Nothing to it. No more effort than what you would have gone walking by a table, picking up an M&M, eating it while you never missed a stride. That's what freaked me out. I didn't go out, I did not go into Boca Raton Pass without having at least two pistols with me. I had an automatic for number of rounds, and I had a 357 revolver because it will fire underwater. I said, if I'm going in that water, something's coming after me, I'm taking it with me, at least, or at least letting it know I was there. This ain't going to be, okay, I'm going to try and punch you in the nose. This thing is monster. So, judging by the age of that fish was probably close to 100 years old. So, easily was there in World War II. And after World War II is when they started naming big, scary, crazy things Hitler. So, that dark, that black was probably a dark fish in the 50s when it would have been named. So I'm going to say Robert and I have seen Hitler.
Yeah. I mean, there were several years where Frank was, what's the right word? I don't even know what the right...
Reluctantly going along with you on your adventures.
Yes. I was trying to break the world record hammerhead at the time. So for a couple years there, he was entertaining my young, naive self with going out after these sharks, and there was quite a few incidences where we ran into some extremely large hammerheads. But that one there, and Frank's Superman. I mean, he does a lot of stuff.
Really stupid stuff, yes.
Yes. And he's regretting some of it from the 70s and the 80s now, but he's done a lot of stuff. But the one thing he has never done is really exaggerate. Like, his fish stories, if it was a 150-pound fish, it was a 150-pound fish. The day he was out with that charter with that shark is the only time, still to this day, that I saw him nervous, afraid.
Literally, I went out armed for months.
He came in that night and told me that story, and there was a genuine fear.
You almost can't believe there's a shark in this area that's that big.
It's been a couple of years since anyone's seen one over 20 foot out there, but it was out there for the first 15 years that I was working at the shop and the first 25 that he was at the shop.
Now, mind you, this is going back into the early 2000s when we used to see that fish all the time. I haven't been out there to see if it's still there, but for years, I took Robert around trying to help him break the world record. And I've probably caught literally dozens of fish that could have been records, but I've just never had the inclination to break a record. I like working my bait shop. I like what I do. I like my customers. I want to deal with that. I don't have a huge recognition thing for as far as, you know, look at me, I'm great. You know?
Yeah, and that wasn't it for me at the time.
No, you just had a personal quest.
Yeah, that was just literally a personal quest because I'm not by any means an ego person at all with that stuff.
I think we're very happy with where we are.
Absolutely.
And, you know, let the rest of the world break the records, and we'll do what we do, and we have fun.
And I got cool memories out of it, so I'm good with that.
All right.
Going back to the big sharks, though, are they a problem or not a problem?
That was kind of the point we're getting to here. If you go out to Boca Raton Pass and you hook a tarpon, and all of a sudden the shark comes up and just destroys that tarpon, bad shark, good shark, or sandwich shark? People get just horribly upset because the shark ate a tarpon that they were trying to catch. Now, what's your opinion of that, RJ?
Sharks eat tarpon. That's what they do. And whether it happens to be the one on the end of your line, which you actually made it a little bit easier for them because now you've got a tired tarpon out there, or it's a tarpon that they've ambushed, and either way, sharks eat tarpon. And you're not changing the balance of nature by having the tarpon on the end of your line get eaten by a shark. It's just the way the game is played out there. Sharks eat tarpon.
Well, I think you're changing the balance a little bit.
You're making it easier
because in nature, and this is with sharks, just like wolves, they're going to take the weak, the sick, and the young. But you're taking an animal that potentially was 100% healthy and wounding it, essentially, for them. So it'd be no different than going out in the field and, let's say, shooting an elk outside of Yellowstone Park, and as it takes off from you, it happens to run 200 yards, and the wolves catch it because it's wounded. But it was a perfectly healthy elk before you took a shot at it. So the same thing goes here with where you're catching a tarpon, you're wiggling it out there in front of them. So you are changing the balance a little bit, but they don't know that that's what you're doing. Their instinct is to find the weakest of that link, of that whole school of fish.
Distress, that's what they're looking
for.
Well,
yeah, and I mean, once it's on the line, it's thrashing its head, it's shaking back and forth, it's doing power runs.
It's putting out some blood because of the claspers, the gill rakers. They always shake their head so violently that they actually break a couple little blood vessels inside their gills, which they live 100% from that. It's just normal. But you've got all...
You're having a bloody nose.
Yeah, yeah. It's just...
You don't die from a bloody nose, no. But there is blood.
Unless you go swimming with sharks.
Unless you go swimming with sharks. So... it's a big thing out there. Now, I hear people when dolphin eat their fish next to the boat, sharks eat the tarpon on the line, and they get really upset about the whole thing. I think, yes, it does increase to a small degree what the sharks would get, but I think if we went back before people got there, sharks were eating tarpon.
They still do. They get videos every summer of sharks chasing down tarpon schools out along the beaches and wrecking perfectly free swimming fish, not molested, you know, and that it's what they do, you know.
I think it makes it easier for them, but not really changing the outcome of what would have had to happen.
Right, exactly.
But except for the fact if you see this, if you're out there and you're fortunate or unfortunate and you have a 6-foot tarpon on, you've got a 150-pound fish on, it's jumping out of the water going crazy, and all of a sudden it goes down, dives deep, and just tries to run, and you're pulling, turning around, get it right up by the boat where it's going to be the slowest, shortest leash on it. You know, it can't go very far because you're right there by the boat, and all of a sudden to have a 400-pound bull shark come up and bite it in half right next to you, 3 feet in front of your face. You won't forget it.
No.
You won't forget that. You're going to be...
You just had a National Geographic moment. You know, it's one of the most spectacular things in the world. But see, some of these people complain that there's a problem with those sharks. And this is what they do every year. It's kind of like going out to your school of bait fish out in the center of the harbor that you want to cast net to go catch snook and then complaining about all the Spanish mackerel that are around feeding on those bait fish. You know, that's what they're doing. The food source is there, and it happens to be concentrated into a small area. It's like going to Alaska during the salmon run, and there's 50 bears in this 2-mile stretch of river feeding on salmon. Does that mean there's a bear population problem? Because you could go there any other time of the year when there's
no
salmon.
That's a pretty good analogy. I never thought of that one before.
He did that. It came out really well and made some sense.
That was actually pretty good, Robert.
Go there any other time of the year when there's no salmon in that river, you're not going to see a bear.
Right.
So they're there for that period of time.
So are bears eating your salmon, and should you be upset about it?
Right.
And also the shark, tarpon, and other big fish cycle has been going on for millions of years, and neither one has wiped the other one out.
Yeah.
And
well,
by
and
the
it,
fact that we recreational fish and you get a tarpon on during the course of a day and a shark gets it has no impact at all in those numbers and those interactions.
No, if anything, I mean the sharks are definitely getting less. I mean they're in pretty tight concentrations in those passes and around those school of tarpon, whether they're just off the beach or in the passes. They're following that food source, but large sharks are getting rarer and rarer all across the world, so they're the ones that actually are kind of in threat. But to think that we have an issue with them, because it's funny, because it'll only be for like 5 days now in the past where you have a bunch of bull sharks that wolf pack your fish, and then they thin out for a couple days. Then they seem to come back again for another 4 or 5 days, and then they're not as big of a problem again.
Are they doing the same thing as the tarpon? The tarpon come to Boca Grande Bass Shallow Harbor, one, for the food. Tons of crabs flowing through, lots of thread fins, lots of glass minnows, all this food. It's a big feast, but it's also to make babies.
Absolutely.
So it's a meet and greet. Okay, yeah, I like you. Let's go get together and make a bunch of babies.
Mm-hmm.
And are the sharks doing the same thing?
They're not breeding, but they're giving birth. They're here to give birth and then to build up their food, food fat reserves after giving birth to all these pups.
All right. So how many pups will a bull shark have?
Average size adult bull shark, which is about 9 to 10 foot, is a completely sexually mature shark, would be anywhere between 10 and 15 pups.
Really?
Yeah.
They'll be
about
six
to 10.
Six to 10, really, on black tip.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I had no idea they had so many babies.
Well, black tip babies are born about 12 to 13 inches long. And a bull shark is born about 18 to 24 inches long.
Yeah, but now these are in like a jelly sac inside the female. And when they come out of the female, they get their way out of that little sac. They're not egg-borne. They're live birth sharks, but correct, they're raised in like sacs inside the mother.
Yes. Yes.
Kind of like a litter of puppies, except they're all in their own little hardcore bag so that the little buggers don't eat their mother.
What's the technical term for that?
I was going to say placenta.
Well, if it's a live birth, it's this, and if it's an egg layer, it's something else.
Yeah.
Viviparous.
But they're neither oviparous. Live birth or egg layers. They're kind of in between that.
Yeah, they're inside their own individual gelatin sac in there. But yeah, there are some sharks that actually where those babies will come out of that little sac and cannibalize their siblings inside the mother.
Okay.
You know, they definitely will eat each other no matter where they are. Even
right.
Even though they haven't been born yet, if that's one of the purposes of the sac is to keep them apart.
Yeah, and what they do is the big sharks come here to give birth, and they give birth inside the harbor so the babies can go into the flats where it's shallower because mom will eat the young.
Okay, so yeah.
That'd help get a lot of kids to move out of the house if parents could eat their young sometimes.
Humans
get
are,
out of the basement.
My grandfather threatened me at one point, yeah.
You said that the jellyfish were far more, better than us because 4 million individual creatures make up a jellyfish, and they all get along and swim forward, and humans can't do that. And now we're finding out that sharks actually eat their young, make them leave. So do alligators. Alligators, yeah. Once it reaches a certain size, it's like, okay, you can grow up. I'm going to protect you, but once you hit this size, you got to go, or your lunch.
Yep.
Humans could learn a lot from nature.
They could.
Yeah. I mean, all right, anyway. speaking of, yes, distancing. Hi, RJ.
Hi.
Okay. I think you're either saying hi rather enthusiastically or telling
you got
10 minutes left.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. I'm still trying to get over the vision of that snorkel and mascot for him, social distancing. Social distancing. The piers in Charlotte County are open as of today or tomorrow?
Tomorrow.
Today.
Tomorrow? Friday,
right.
Okay, so by the time you're hearing this, Friday you can go back on the piers. And it's kind of neat. Wink News came in and did a story with us about the piers opening. NBC has been into the store. We just did that one today. And the hardest thing, I don't know what they want to hear. I really think what they want to hear is, oh, boy, we've been, down and out, and things have been so bad, and life is horrible. Now the piers are open, and this is going to save the store. I think that's the story they're looking for. I'm not sure. But my story to them was, yes, we did not make as much money. We did not have as much business, but we needed to do this. Before they closed the pier, there'd be 100 people on the pier that should have, in a normal time, had 25 or 30 on it. But there was nowhere for a lot of people to go, nothing for them to do, so they packed onto the piers.
Right.
And that's why the governor shut it down. Now, I didn't mention that part on there because, we have a Republican government. Let's face it, they're TV channels. They're definitely not interested in good news about our government. But DeSantis did, in Charlotte County, they didn't have a choice in what they did. People would pull up, see a pier crowded with people, and walk onto the pier. And when a tried to do in every interview was remind people have plan A and plan B, maybe even plan C. I'm going to drive to this pier, too many people, I'm going to go to the next pier. Up, a lot of people there, all right, I'm going to go to my third choice. I will find a place where I don't have to stand shoulder to shoulder with other people. A, I don't want to fish that way. B, why would you want to fish that way? So have a couple of alternatives in mind. Don't get so focused. This is where I'm going. This is what I'm going to do. And the hell with everything else. It's just not feasible or realistic in the age of coronavirus. Now, I believe if you're going to get it, you're going to get it. If you're going to go out and get the coronavirus, you're going to get it or you're not going to get it. That's my belief. It's just, I mean, when I was a kid, we had measles, mumps, chicken pox. I think polio was still around. And all of the epidemics that I've lived through in my life, and it's always been, I'm either going to get it or I'm not. And I didn't think this one was, for me, was going to be any different. But there was a lot of very vulnerable people, and it's exceptionally contagious. One person infects six. With the regular flu, I think one person infects almost three. But with this, it's one person infects six others. So that's bad. Me, I literally think most of us at the store have had it at one point or another. We did get one of our guys tested. It was negative. So, no, I guess we didn't have it, but I kind of wish we would have, you know, right. get it over with and go on. But with the piers opening up, this is going to, you've got a fishing pole, social distance with your rod, stay rod length apart from each other. But finger mullet, big deal on the piers. Because people fishing next to the piers, all of a sudden finger mullet started going crazy as bait. I mean, we're selling more of that than shrimp almost now. Shrimp's still number one.
Frozen finger mullet.
But frozen finger mullet are, I mean, just ranking way up there. Cutting them in half, cutting the tails off. Put out whole, they're not as good. If you don't break the skin and get that entrails smell, the... You know, the guts.
Some of the blood, some of the oil, all of it flowing, yeah.
But it's just crazy how, because over the last, I would say, 5-10 years, we have always sold finger mullet. We might go through a half a case a week. We're going through 6, 8, 10 cases a week right now. This is nuts. That's times 40 each box.
Each box.
Let me ask. The dumb question of the day, because that's my job, is to ask the dumb question of the day. Did this happen because something's going on in nature and everything is eating finger mullet? Or is it because somebody decided that was a good idea to use finger mullet and everybody else has picked up on it?
Yes.
Yes, yeah. To all of the above.
We don't know.
I don't know. I'm gonna go with B, but there are a lot of people catching fish with it, so I don't know if it's B working to A or if A to B.
Yeah, I suspect that it's somebody caught a bunch of fish using finger mullet, frozen finger mullet, and the word spread, and that's the bait of choice. Everybody wants it, and fish will eat stuff.
I've just never seen it this drastic before. Yeah. Not in the 21 years that I've been there.
Years ago, everybody wanted frozen finger mullet. That was the number one choice on the piers. Silver sides have been... We just started slowing down selling those because there's not a lot of snapper around right now.
Right.
There's a lot of smaller snapper, but most of the keeper sizes aren't as prevalent as they were. Whenever the mangrove snappers are there, silver side's number one bait. But with right now, you got black tips, Spanish mackerel, bull sharks. I mean, how many different sharks are accessible from the piers?
At least 5 different species, at least.
Sharp nose, black nose,
bonnet head, hammerhead, lemon shark, bull shark, and black tip. So okay. 7 sharks.
So you at got least. At least 7 different types of shark that you can catch from a pier. Now, what we try and tell people, one about 3-4 feet below a bobber, and then one probably free lined out. Now, if you get a little too much current, you got to add some weight. You don't really want it laying on the bottom. What you want it doing is kind of bouncing up and down off of the bottom.
Right.
Where the current will grab the line and kind of in almost like a bullwhip fashion where it your line is up by the surface going all the way to the bottom and it starts to bow with the current in order to release the pressure on the line, it lifts the bait up, and that allows the line to settle back. The bait goes back to the bottom. Then the pressure on the line starts building up. It starts bowing up. And then in order to relieve that pressure on it, it pops the bait off the bottom, and it just keeps recycling that way. If you have too much current, the bait just comes right up by the top. So you got to have a little bit of weight on it. But the trick is not to put a lot, just enough to get it to kind of go up and down off of the bottom. And same thing if you're putting it out under a bobber. If you've got a bobber out there and the tide isn't really strong, you don't need any weight down by your bait. But if the current's going a little faster, you're going to keep adding weight down to the bottom, maybe even just use a jig head, because you've got to be able to keep that bait in the water, not pulled straight out behind the bobber. You can see it on the surface. I've gone out to the pier and looked out at people's lines, and you can see the line, you see their bobber, and then you look a little bit back, and you see their bait dangling right there in the top.
Almost like it's trying to water ski.
Yeah. Like it's water skiing behind the bobber.
Yeah. It's pretty hilarious.
So it's just a whole different way of looking at it.
And it is a little delicate dance trying to find that right weight, but that's why you're adding those weights to it.
So, anyway, Charlotte County, Florida, every county's different. The city's been different than the county. Counties are different throughout Florida. Miami-Dade over there, they still got it closed up. Hopefully they all stay home for just a little while longer.
Tampa's still got all theirs closed, too, and they're not planning on opening them for a little while longer.
The neat part about it is we've got a great governor here. DeSantis, you did good. Charlotte County, you did good. This is one of the few times where I'm actually proud that I live in Florida. Thank God I see what a mess some of the northern states are. We're praying for you guys up there. Stay healthy. Be safe. Be sane. Don't let the politics drive you crazy up there. You'll be down soon enough. All right, Fish and Frank here, Robert over there, RJ way up there, overlooking us all. Bye. I'm going fishing just to ease the mind.